Case number 20-6328, United States of America versus Liviu Sorin Nedelcu. Oral argument is not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Lyons for the appellant.
Good afternoon, Mr. Lyons. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Thomas Lyons, and I represent the appellant, Liviu Sorin Nedelcu. Briefly, by way of background, Your Honors, Mr. Nedelcu pled guilty to count one of a superseding indictment in this case, charging a violation of the RICO statute, section 1962. This is a case regarding the application of certain guidelines and the permissibility of some of the guideline enhancements that the district court imposed upon my client. The base guideline for the RICO statute is contained in United States guideline 2E1.1, and basically that directs that the offense level is 19 or the offense level applicable to the underlying racketeering activity. The commentary which the district court seized upon states that where there is more than one underlying offense, treat each underlying offense as if it is contained in a separate count of conviction for purposes of determining the base offense level. The underlying activity here, the racketeering activity, is fraud and money laundering. And without going to all the details, essentially the guideline, the base level was 27 after several enhancements under the fraud guideline for amount of loss, for operating outside the United States, and similar things that we don't contest. He came to a base offense level of 27. Then we come to what I believe is the first assignment of error in this case. The district court erred in applying 2S1.1 specific offense characteristic because the plain text of 2S1.1B2B requires an actual conviction under 18 United States Code 1956, the money laundering statute. Specifically, the provision provides under specific offense characteristics, if the defendant was convicted under 1956, increased by two levels, and if that provision applies and the offense involves sophisticated laundering, we increase by two levels additionally. So the court added four additional levels, resulting in a guideline range of 78 to 97 months. The sentence imposed was 82 months. It is the appellant's position that neither of these two enhancements apply, because in order for them to apply, a specific conviction under 1956, the money laundering statute, is required. So the plain text of the guideline provision prohibits what the district court did. In addition, under USSG 1B1.3, under relevant conduct, there is an application note that appears to be right on point, and it talks about factors requiring a conviction under a specific statute. It provides that a particular guideline may expressly direct that a particular factor be applied only if the defendant was convicted of a particular statute. And it uses the 2S1.1B2B exception as its main guidance there. So not only does 2S1.1's text prohibit what the district court did, the comment number 7 to 1B1.3 specifically addresses this particular issue. And we argued all that at the district court, which was overruled.
Mr. Lyons, even if you're correct in that argument, the district court also applied the sentencing guideline 1B1.2C, which is the guidelines regarding a stipulation establishing additional offenses. And so that is an independent reason for the enhancement here. And what's wrong with that? The enhancement on based upon that guideline?
Well, there's a couple of things that I believe are wrong with that, Your Honor. First of all, it's true that a plea agreement can stipulate specifically that there are additional offenses or that there's a more serious offense under 1B1.2.
Now, do you admit that the facts, the factual basis in the plea establish the elements of money laundering?
I think I did so at the district court, Your Honor.
Okay, I thought you did too.
To be perfectly candid, the question is whether or not we actually stipulated that this.
Well, isn't that? I mean, a stipulation admission as to the facts isn't that sufficient? And what authority do you have to the contrary?
Well, the authority I have to the contrary is the plea agreement itself. If you look at paragraph 3 of the plea agreement, we specifically reserved our right to disagree about the specific enhancements of 2S1.1. I don't think you can garner a conclusion of stipulation when the very document that you're using to draw that conclusion specifically disagrees about the
app. But the stipulation is to the facts necessary to establish the offense. And isn't that all the guideline requires?
I don't think it is. You know, obviously you could disagree with me, but I don't think it is. When we're talking about a more serious offense, and the other argument I've made in this section of the brief is that it is a serious offense.
Well, they both have the same statutory maximum, don't they? Aren't they statutory maximum 20 years for both the RICO and the money laundering?
They are, Judge. The question is that the metric by which we should use? Now, the United States has cited a couple of cases that in passing talk about the statutory maximum, but I don't think either one of those cases that are cited, one was a Supreme Court case and one was another case, I don't think there's any analysis in there as to how we determine what a more serious offense is. I cited to the court in my brief a 10th Circuit case, United States versus Roberts, did not find any Sixth Circuit case on point, which directly considered the issue of whether 1B1.2, they were analyzing whether it's impermissibly vague with respect to the term more serious offense, and they looked to the guidelines, not the statutory maximums, for the metric of comparison, finding that the guidelines provide a clear means by which the relative seriousness of the offense encompassed by the stipulated conduct can be evaluated. So I think that is closer to the issue that presents itself to this court. I don't know that the Sixth Circuit has actually decided this specific issue of what metric you use as to what is a more serious offense. I can tell you as a practical matter that my client was sentenced to a significantly longer prison sentence as a result of this. So it seems to me common sense would dictate that it is a more serious offense. But I don't think there's a lot of Sixth Circuit guidance on this issue. I do not think that the two cases cited by the government really answer that question. And I do think this 10th Circuit case gives the court at least some persuasive authority when it's analyzing whether this is a more serious offense.
The commentary that you're relying on, doesn't it only apply to 1B1.2A and not 2C?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, Your Honor? I'm having a hard time following you there.
Well, when you're talking about the more serious offense, right?
Right.
You're relying on what?
Well, I'm relying on the fact that the court determined that my client was guilty of a money laundering offense, even though he did not plead guilty to a money laundering offense.
Okay. And you're relying on a specific provision, right?
Right.
But I was under the impression, I could be reading it wrong, that the provision that you're relying on applies to 2A, but not 2C. And 2C was what Judge Griffin was asking you about. The section that says that if you if you stipulate to another offense.
Well, as I read C, it talks about a plea agreement containing a stipulation that specifically establishes the commission of an additional offense shall be treated as if the defendant had been convicted of an additional offense charging that offense. I think the commentary talks about under what circumstances should a defendant be held accountable for that additional offense. And I think the point of the commentary is that if you're going to do that to a defendant without an express conviction, then there has to be something explicit in the plea agreement. A stipulation means that both parties have agreed as to the effect of a factual concession. That's what a stipulation is, seems to me.
Does that mean you'd like for us to vacate the plea agreement and send the case back for resentencing?
I don't know that that's what I'm asking the court to do. I think the district court was in error in looking at 1B1.2 because it characterized it simply as an additional offense when in fact it is a more serious offense. And I think the court's analysis, the district judge's analysis, simply ignored that provision. He said it was not a more serious offense. And then the question that poses itself to this court is how do you determine what is a more serious offense? Is it a comparison of the statutory maximums? Is it a comparison of the guidelines, as the 10th Circuit has indicated? Common sense to me indicates that the defendant, as they consult their lawyer about a guideline provision, about a guideline application, they're talking to their lawyer about how the guidelines affect their sentence. So it seems to me that that's really what's running the show, because that's what ultimately determines the penalty in the case.
Of course, when the plea was submitted and the sentencing occurred, you knew that, your client knew that there had been no stipulation about the enhancement based on the underlying offense. You knew that and went ahead with the plea agreement anyway. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I don't know that at the time that he entered his plea agreement, this was a concern, frankly.
Well, it had to be a concern since you put right in the plea agreement that the defendant does not agree to this enhancement. It says that right in the agreement.
It does. So I'm not sure why my client would be held accountable for being concerned about whether or not this was going to wind up in a guideline enhancement under 2S1.1 when the guideline specifically provides that it can't be used. So maybe I'm misunderstanding Your Honor's question, and I apologize if I am, but I think I'm out of time.
In other words, there's no stipulation that the court couldn't use that enhancement. I take the language that the defendant does not agree to the enhancement to simply mean that if the court did resort to that enhancement, your client would not agree with that and would not waive any argument that your client might have based upon that issue.
Judge, the bottom line is, I suppose theoretically I could have asked the court to suspend the sentencing and asked to either withdraw the plea, but you need to understand that this was a case that went on for several years, and there were hundreds of thousands of pages of documents. It took us a long, long time to work out these pleas, and we were on the verge of a trial that was going to last multiple weeks. So just as a practical matter, I don't know that I could have anticipated that or that I should have asked the district court to allow him to withdraw his plea. Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, thank you. You have your rebuttal time. We'll hear from the government.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court. Sonia Ralston for the United States. I understand the court has some questions about the 1B1.2 issue, but I think I want to start back in the RICO guideline itself. As this court explained in Havis, the commentary to the guidelines is binding so long as the text of the guidelines will bear the construction. Here, the text of guidelines 2E1.1A2 says that the court is to use the guideline offense level applicable to the underlying racketeering activity. As the district court pointed out, that naturally begs the question, what is included? Because in a racketeering case, in a RICO case, there necessarily must be a pattern of racketeering activity. So there's always going to be more than one action. So when you're talking about the underlying racketeering activity, you have to ask, which underlying racketeering activity? The commentary answers that question. It says, when there is more than one activity, treat each underlying offense as if it contained a separate count of conviction. Now that sets you up then to take those separate offenses and then apply what the guideline text says, which is go back to the guideline for those offenses and figure out the offense level. So here, as we all agree, there were two underlying offenses, fraud and money laundering. You separate those out and you go back to the guidelines for each of them, treating them each as a separate count of conviction. Under the fraud guideline, you get an offense level of 27. Under the money laundering guideline, you get an offense level of 31. Because 31 is higher, guideline 2E1.1 instructs to use that. And then he received 3 points off for acceptance of responsibility for a final level of 28. Well, the district court.
That seems to come from nowhere, though.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
It seems to come from nowhere, though. I mean, where did the guidelines themselves say that?
You mean in the text as opposed to the commentary?
Not the commentary. Where do the guidelines themselves tell you to do this?
In 2E1.1A2, it says to use the offense level applicable to the underlying racketeering activity. And that, as the district court noted, leads to the question, when there is more than one, when they are different, how do I know which one to use? And the commentary answers that question, right? It permissibly explains, interprets the text of the guideline, and therefore it's binding. It says, take them, separate them out, treat them each as a count of conviction, and then go figure out, using all of Chapter 2 and parts A, B, C, and D of Chapter 3, which has the higher offense level.
I mean, doesn't the guideline specifically say that if the defendant was convicted under 18 U.S.C. 1956, increased by two levels?
It does, Your Honor.
But okay. The guidelines. And you admit the defendant wasn't convicted under 18 U.S.C. 1956, right?
I agree that his judgment does not say 1956, yes.
Okay, and you agree he wasn't convicted under. So, I mean, doesn't that specific text of the guideline conflict with the commentary? That's the point they argue.
I understand that's their argument, but I don't think that it conflicts because we're talking about two different things. The text, the commentary that we're looking to, interprets the guideline for the RICO offense. And the text in the RICO offense that says underlying racketeering activity, that's what's being interpreted here in the commentary to the RICO guideline, needs interpretive help. It calls for a question of how do I treat multiple offenses? So then that commentary tells you, it answers that question. It says, treat them as separate offenses of conviction. And then when you're applying this pass through, this umbrella offense, go back to the other guideline, or forward here, I guess is 2S is after E, and figure out what applies. Okay. And so the guidelines do this consistently. You know, the conspiracy guideline tells you to look to the underlying activity. The in the 1B1.2 also tells you that, you know, and this commentary in, or sorry, not the commentary, the text in 1B1.2, both in A and C and D, talks about treating the multiple offenses as though it is a count of conviction. And you see the same language in actually the commentary to the money laundering guideline itself, where it tells you that if you have a conviction, this is application note 3C of the money laundering guideline, that if your conviction is for 1956H, which is the conspiracy provision, but the only object of that conspiracy is 1957, which is the lower money laundering, it's the transactional, not the concealment, that you should treat it as a 1957 offense, not a 1956 offense, even though the judgment in that case is going to say 1956. So this is the guidelines consistently in every case saying, look at the actual conduct, look at what the defendant did, look at what the stipulated facts establish, and use that. So also,
do we have to accept your argument on this section for you to win?
On the 2E1.1 commentary? No, you don't. As the district court noted, you can use 1B1.2C and get to the same conclusion.
Isn't that an easier route to affirm?
I think they're equally easy. Either way, you get to the question of if you are treating this thing that's not on the judgment as though it is a count of conviction, and whether you get there through the 2E1.1 commentary or the text in 1B1.2C,
okay,
you're getting to the same result.
I mean, to me, it seems like the less resistant way to affirm, because otherwise we have to determine whether there's a conflict between the text of the guidelines, the commentary, and I don't see a conflict in regard to 1B1.2C. That's all. But the argument there is somehow the stipulation is not a stipulation that there was a conviction, but that there is a stipulation as to the facts that establish the bases for the offense. That's all.
Yeah. What do you need to apply that section?
1B1.2C applies when the plea agreement contains a stipulation as to the facts that establish the commission of an additional offense. So here we have a stipulation as to the facts, which I'm happy to go through those facts, but I think the facts are less at issue than the law. And the facts establish the offense because they establish all four elements of the money laundering offense. Now, I think I can answer your question about the difference between A and C. Okay, so A is about a case where you, as the commentary talks about, you committed a robbery, you're going to plead to theft, but the guidelines is calculated under robbery. Okay, in order to do that, you have to agree to use the robbery guideline. And that's what the commentary says. It says, for the purposes of a stipulation for the purposes of subsection A, only if both the defendant and the government explicitly agree that the factual statement or stipulation is a stipulation for such purpose. And this was added to the guidelines after the Supreme Court's decision in Braxton, which, you know, said, oh, it's confusing about whether you actually need to stipulate and agree to use it for this purpose. And then the commission went back and amended it and said, you know, like, for the purposes of A, you actually need to be explicit. Okay. The reason is that there, and whether you use the guideline, I'll get to the guidelines versus the stat max, but all of the cases that I've read, and there've been dozens of them, talk about instances where the two offenses do have different statutory maximums. And the reason you would do this, right, is to say, is that you're bound by the stat max of the lower crime, right? So you plead to the theft, which has a 5-year maximum, and use the guideline for the robbery, but you can't get more than the 5 years because that's the thing you pled to. Okay? And that's, you know, Roberts does this. It's a 15-year thing that they use the guideline for, and a 10-year max on the thing that he pleads to. So, you know, all of the cases have this difference in the statutory maximum, and that's why this guideline exists. Okay, C is for cases where you have, like this case, like lots of cases, the example in the commentary is about multiple bank robberies, okay, where you plead to a bank robbery, and then you admit the facts that establish additional bank robberies. Then in calculating the guidelines, you treat it as though there are multiple bank robberies. The same thing applies here. Okay, he pleaded to the count of conviction as the RICO conspiracy. The facts in the plea agreement establish the money laundering conspiracy. So you treat it as an additional offense. When you go to the additional offense rules, it says to use the one with the highest level. Here, either they're the same or because of this pass through through 2E1.1 or the money laundering is the higher level. Either way, you get to the 31, you include these enhancements. The seriousness, so, and that kind of brings me back to this more serious offense question and why you know that, well, why I think that you shouldn't use the guidelines level, which is because in cases like this one, it's circular, right? The guidelines level for 2E1.1 is the guidelines level for the other offense, right? And so whether you apply these enhancements to 2S1.1 affects what the guidelines level in 2E1.1 is. So you can't just compare them like without the extra information, right? You can't compare them in a vacuum. The only way you can figure out what the level in 2E1.1 is by looking to 2S1.1. And so you can't make this comparison using the guidelines because the guidelines have all these cross-references. Okay, you can make the comparison using the code book, right? Because the stat max is right there in the code book. And that is a clean, easy way to determine which is more serious. Also, today, right, in the post-Booker world, the guidelines are advisory. And we know that the, you know, what counts as the seriousness of the offense is what's in the code, what the statutory maximum is, because that's where we're looking to what the limits of the court's discretion is. And that's why I think you should use the statutory maximum to determine more serious. And therefore, this case, where we have the same statutory maximum, you're not in A, you're in C.
Well, I mean, are there situations where the offense with the higher statutory maximum has the lower sentence?
I suppose it's possible. I don't know. I can't think of one offhand, but I suppose it's possible that that could happen. But if that happens, it doesn't matter, right? Because if the defendant pleads to the offense that has the lower statutory maximum, but the higher guidelines level, who cares what the guidelines level is to the offense with the lower statutory maximum? Because the guidelines, everywhere you look, say use the higher level, use the greater offense level. So the guidelines would never instruct you to use the lower offense level from the crime with the higher statutory maximum. They're always going to instruct you to use the higher guidelines level, regardless of which crime that's from.
All right, Ms. Ralston, getting back to Judge White's original question about the analysis of what's the most serious offense. I mean, it's your position, we don't have to go there because that applies only to A and not C, and we're dealing here with C. So
yes.
we don't go there at all, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Okay, and what do you need to constitute a stipulation to another offense?
It says, containing a stipulation that specifically establishes the commission of an additional offense. Okay, so the commission of the offense, what establishes that are the facts. And if you compare...
But when you say stipulation, you don't think you need anything other than facts that would establish that offense. You don't need the defendant's intent to be stipulating to another crime.
No. And I think if you look at the commentary in notes 1 and note C for 1B1.2, it shows this. In note 1, it talks about the stipulation for the purposes of subsection A, you have to explicitly agree that you're doing this. Okay. In the note 3, talking about subsection C, it doesn't say that. And it says, if the defendant is convicted of one count of robbery, but as part of the plea agreement, admits to having committed two additional robberies, then you count it as though there's three robberies. So I think the text of the guidelines also say that, but if you look at, you know, the commentary is making it 100% clear, and the way that this evolves in response to the Supreme Court's decision in Braxton, I think also makes that clear. We ask that the court, if there are no further questions, We ask that you affirm the judgment.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Focusing in on the 1B1.2 issue, which the court has obviously focused on. The question becomes, I guess, whether we're dealing with A or C. I had made the argument that this is a more serious offense under subsection A. And now the court is, you know, questioning opposing counsel about a plea agreement that contains a stipulation that specifically establishes the commission of an additional offense. And under that, the commentary would suggest that you don't need the defendant's express permission to say, yes, I am stipulating to an additional offense. The problem still is not resolved simply by resolving that issue, because all the C says is that it shall be treated as if the defendant has been convicted of an additional count charging the offense. It doesn't tell you what the upshot of that is. That would depend on what the referral guideline is going to be. So in this specific case, the guideline that we're talking about, the enhancements that have been provided are under 2S1.1. The statutory language or the guideline language itself is that you need a conviction. So is C in conflict with that statutory language? I think it may be. The other question that comes to mind is, if the result is as counsel just suggested, how do you deal with what's in 1B1.3, comment 7? Essentially, you're basically saying that because of 1B1.2, we're going to ignore B1.3's express provision that a conviction has to be had under 1956. So I don't see how you can read 1B1.2C in isolation, because I still think there's tension between that and the requirement of a conviction under 2S1.1 and the tension with 1B1.3 note 7, which I think is what the two cases that I cited to you talk about. And that's the Ruggiero case and the Rossi case. Both of those held that you cannot use this provision to enhance the penalty. So I don't think that's the end of analysis, is simply by saying it's a 1B1.2C case. And because he's stipulated to the underlying facts, therefore that closes the argument. I think the question then becomes, if that's true, then how do you employ that with 2S1.1 and the comment to 1B1.3, note 7? Thank you, Your Honor. I would ask that you reverse that portion of the sentence that imposes the 4-level enhancement.
Thank you, counsel. And Mr. Lyons, the court very much appreciates you accepting the appointment of this case under the Criminal Justice Act. I know you do this as a service to the court, so thank you for that. The case is submitted.